The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
The coronavirus isn't just a health concern in China. It could be a threat to the political system, too.
China had this brand, we're efficient, we can do everything, we can build faster. And now we see that authoritarian governments don't tell the truth to their own people.
Also, the Trump administration is loosening restrictions on landmines. We talk with an aid worker who knows the danger firsthand.
We struck a landmine. Yeah, I ended up losing, my right foot. And then ended up losing the rest of the leg that afternoon.
And a Russian man opened a zoo in eastern Ukraine. Then war with Russia made it hard to get supplies. So where do you find 3,000 pounds of meat each week to feed the lions? I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. The reported numbers on this coronavirus story just keep growing. More than 17,000 cases have now been diagnosed in mainland China. Another 153 people outside of China have also tested positive for the virus. So far, at least 362 people have died. Now, those current numbers pale in comparison to other infectious diseases, like the seasonal flu, for example. But uncertainty about this new virus has led to some dramatic responses, from evacuations to quarantines to travel bans. Travel and tourism do not stop on a dime, though. Thailand is a top tourist destination for Chinese travelers. People in Thailand have concerns, not just about the coronavirus. They also need to make a living. The World's Patrick Nguyen has our story from Bangkok.
The Temple of the Emerald Buddha is one of the most visited places in Southeast Asia, and it really is magnificent. Outside the temple, I meet a man named Gai Ti. He's in his 30s, and he's scanning the crowd for anyone who looks Chinese. If he spots someone, he runs up and says, I ask him to translate into Thai. It means, hello, do you need a tour guide? Gai Ti speaks Chinese, so for a fee, he takes Chinese tourists into the temple, shows them the golden spires and the Buddha statue carved of emerald. This temple is like the Eiffel Tower in Paris. You come to Bangkok, you sort of have to come here. So it gets really crowded in there. Gai Ti says the majority of the tourists are from China. If his voice sounds a bit muffled, he's speaking through a mask, because Gai Ti is a little freaked out. He's doing exactly what doctors tell you not to do, going into large gatherings every day. But look, he says, this is my job. This is how he feeds his family. And there are a lot of people like this in Thailand, like this other young woman I meet nearby, selling flowers to Chinese tourists on the street. She says, I'm scared to die, she says. My kids are not yet grown. Then she cuts me off saying, that's all I've got to say. A district official named Lei, who looks after the vendors here, he comes up and says, hey, don't make a big deal out of this virus thing on the news, okay? Tourist numbers are already down. These people may be scared, but they need the money. Don't make it worse. Instead, he gives me some advice. Lei says the virus actually can't even spread in a place like Thailand. See, Wuhan is a cold place, he says, and a virus from there will never survive the Thai heat. Hard to tell if he actually believes this, but the tropical weather does attract Chinese tourists. 11 million Chinese nationals come to Thailand every year. And this is a new-ish phenomenon. More and more Chinese nationals being able to afford a foreign getaway. That's an ad in Chinese by a Thai mall, urging travelers to come on a shopping spree. There are constant flights to Thailand from cities all over China, including Wuhan. Well, there were flights from Wuhan until China's government shut them down. But thousands of people from Wuhan did come around Chinese New Year, more than a week ago. And that was pre-quarantine, right when the virus was really starting to spread. Most have gone home, but thousands still remain. And that has led to some paranoia. That is a Thai news announcer saying, "This virus is a pandemic. We urge you to take care." Then she cuts to a photo of a big puddle on the floor of a Bangkok train. It's a picture from a Facebook post. Apparently, she says, a Chinese tourist urinated on the train floor. This is not verified, by the way. It's just according to some stranger's Facebook post. But it's on a major news show. This is paranoia veering into prejudice. Another touristy spot is this bejeweled shrine called Erawan. It's also very popular with Chinese travelers. And it's where I meet Tong Poon, a tour guide in his 50s who can sound a bit callous when talking about China. Only about 100 or so have died in China, he tells me. For a big country, that's not so many. He says people who depend on Chinese tourists to make a living are panicked, and not just from the virus. They already see dwindling numbers of tourists from China, and they're worried that, as this goes on, maybe all tourists will stop coming. So the best tactic, Tong Poon says, is to be stoic. Everyone's going to die at some point, he says. Maybe you die young, maybe you die old. What he's really afraid of is poverty. Now that, he says, is way scarier than some virus. For the world, Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
The coronavirus outbreak could go well beyond public health concerns. There's also politics at play. The spread of the virus could destabilize U.S.-China relations, as well as Chinese President Xi Jinping's grip on domestic power. On Friday, the U.S. restricted travel between the U.S. and China. China's reaction to that move could be a sign of tensions to come, according to Nicholas Burns. He's a former U.S. ambassador to NATO and an unpaid advisor to the Joe Biden campaign.
The reaction was swift and it was quite severe. The Chinese Foreign Ministry accused the United States of fear-mongering and taking advantage of the crisis to belittle China. To be fair to President Trump and his administration, that wasn't the motivation. It was to contain the health crisis. And you've seen quickly over the weekend, Marco, the Japanese government, the Australian government, the Singaporean government, many governments taking severe measures to eliminate air travel to China. There are smaller states dependent on China either for trade or aid, like Cambodia and Thailand, that have very publicly said, we're not going to take these restrictive measures because they can't afford to alienate China. The bigger countries can. The bigger countries are also democracies. They have to take their own citizens' views into account because China's so dominant in the international system. So many countries have China as their leading trade partner. Mm. This is now becoming part of this crisis.
What's this going to do, do you think, to Chinese leader Xi Jinping? Because until the Hong Kong protests last summer that started and are still kind of roiling, I mean, he's been kind of widely seen as the strongest Chinese leader since Mao. What is it doing to his power? When and where could this all go?
China's an authoritarian dictatorship, but we've seen in the past that the Chinese people have made their views felt on air quality, on climate change. Now they're making their views felt on this crisis, this pandemic, this health crisis within China itself. Xi Jinping has been front and center in the last week. He's made several major statements. It's a closed system, but we're seeing a lot of criticism from individual Chinese. And frankly, he's being held accountable by other governments around the world who want China to take much more dramatic measures to contain this crisis.
What do you think that should look like to kind of satisfy people? Is it about just accurate data and full data? Is it kind of a statement of contrition of we were not accountable, but we're going to do better now? What do they want?
I don't think contrition is important right now. What's important is transparency and consistently reliable information. So for instance, what the Chinese government really should do is have a spokesperson in Beijing give two daily reports to the world. Here are the number of people infected. Here's how we're trying to limit the crisis. Here's how we would like to work internationally. That's not happening right now. Hmm. Information is leaking out bit by bit, part of it contradictory. And clearly the Chinese government has a responsibility and a self-interest to look like it's on top of this, and it's revealing what it knows. Accurate information might help to curb the anxiety that everyone, I think, around the world is feeling about the possible dimensions of this.
If Xi's credibility does take a hit from all of this, what does that mean in China? I mean, how could that impact his agenda beyond the coronavirus crisis?
He was riding high. He was considered unassailable, as you say, Marco, the strongest leader since Mao. If this is not handled appropriately, and if the reports are true that the Chinese government blocked health authorities in Wuhan in late December, early January from even talking about the crisis and taking elementary measures to contain it, then he is going to be criticized in the Chinese system. I think it's a stretch to say he'd probably lose power. This could affect him and his system down the line. I think it's clear for everyone to see the limits of an authoritarian system of government. China had this brand, we're efficient, we can do everything, we can build faster. And now we see that authoritarian governments don't tell the truth to their own people.
Of course, the coronavirus is already having an effect on stock markets around the world. If Xi Jinping does take a hit, zoom out for us, Nick, beyond the virus, how could that impact relations between the U.S. and China?
If the Chinese continue to blame the United States and make the United States, in effect, responsible for exacerbating the crisis, that's not going to help trust between Washington and Beijing. The economic dimensions of this are such that as we take these temporary measures to restrict travel and the ability to bring Chinese imports into the United States, will that lead to a further decoupling of the Chinese and American countries? Will American companies with manufacturing plants in China decide to relocate them to Vietnam or Bangladesh? Depending on how long this crisis lasts and the severity of the crisis, it could be a major loss of power and influence for China. It could be very harmful to China short and long term.
Nicholas Burns, former U.S. ambassador to NATO and a professor of diplomacy at Harvard. Thanks very much. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Marco.
As the coronavirus continues to spread across mainland China, nearly 60 million people have been placed under lockdown and instructed to stay indoors. So instead of enjoying the Chinese New Year festivals by spending time with family or traveling, many Chinese have found a unique way to entertain themselves, watching live stream footage of two hospitals being built in record time. The construction of the two hospitals in less than 2 weeks has become the hottest show in town. 7,000 workers, roughly 1,000 pieces of heavy machinery, gripping stuff actually, a constant stream of motion. More than 50 million people in China alone have tuned in to the around-the-clock feed. They've watched the Hushenshan Hospital get built in only 8 days. It opened today, ready to treat coronavirus patients. Work on the second hospital is expected to be completed later this week. Both were built based on the model of a Beijing hospital constructed at the height of the SARS outbreak in 2003. That hospital got put up in 7 days. The popularity of the live stream construction has created some unlikely heroes, the construction vehicles themselves. Cement mixers have been given nicknames such as the Cement King and Big White Rabbit. A large flatbed truck carrying construction supplies has been nicknamed Brother Red Bull. China Central Television even set up a social media page where users can vote for their favorite construction rig. The biggest star so far, the small yellow forklifts. Fans call them the cutest and most hardworking forklifts. Well, keep on lifting, Forkies. We're rooting for you. All right, let's move past the Kansas City Chiefs' huge comeback win at the Super Bowl and talk turkey. Turkey was one of the insults leveled at Shakira for this moment that came in her scorching halftime show performance. Take one more listen. Okay, Shakira is Colombian. Her family, though, is Lebanese. And in Lebanon, that sound is known as zagruta. It's a celebratory cheer often done by women at Arab weddings. Spend some time online. You'll also find this video, moments only Arab people understand.
Hey, how are you?
My friend from school arrives tomorrow, says the guy.
From Egypt?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yep, now you know, the zagruta, useful for so many occasions, even the Super Bowl halftime show. Russia and Ukraine and Russia, for obvious reasons, we cannot stop talking about them. But are we even getting the full story? Joshua Yaffa lives and reports in Russia for The New Yorker. In his new book, Between Two Fires, he writes about how complicated life is in Putin's Russia and how, to some degree, he finds the same in Ukraine. Yaffa told me the stories of two people caught between trying to support and defy Putin's regime.
People aren't so cleanly divided into the oppressor and the oppressed. In fact, most people live their lives somewhere in the middle. People with understandable even admirable ambitions, motives, things they want to accomplish in their lives, the way you act those out, the way you realize them is by engaging the state in one way or another and deciding where you bend and in the service of what goal.
So these people are kind of caught between those bookends. And I guess those are the two fires in the title, Between Two Fires.
Exactly. Between Two Fires is a Russian saying, Meshu dvukh ognyeh, and it's kind of like between a rock and a hard place. Mm. You're stuck between two forces larger than yourself. Making it out the other side is just about the best outcome available.
So when it comes to the compromise part, you meet a man who really has to adjust his expectations of the Kremlin as this kind of all-benevolent power. And this guy Oleg is a great example because his story kind of gets at something that's really in the air right now, corruption in this part of the world, Ukraine and Russia. I guess what the particular flavor of corruption is in Crimea. This is a Russian named Oleg Zubkov. Crazy story. He's a zookeeper who ends up with a safari park in Crimea. How did that happen?
He's a really larger-than-life guy. He's originally from Russia. He thought of himself and thinks of himself as a Russian, and he didn't really break a sweat about Crimea being part of Ukraine. But like a lot of people in Crimea, frankly, he fell under the sway of the successful Kremlin propaganda campaign in 2014, then became a quite enthusiastic supporter of annexation.
He's a pretty remarkable guy. I mean, he's also got this YouTube page, and he's in the enclosure, literally lying on the ground playing with lions.
Wow! Представляешь, они все идут к нам. Wow! Ты не рад? Да мы отобьемся с тобой. Не бойся.
Nice growl. Josh, what's going on here?
He's approaching some of the lions in his park. They're these regal beasts, but certainly not the kinds of creatures when you see them up close that you would feel like you would want to approach and give a pet. But that's exactly what Zubkov does. And he's waving them off with his slipper, which he claims is a kind of magic talisman against angry tigers.
Did he convince you to, like, pet them?
Yeah, there was no option. We weren't getting back on that golf cart till I embraced one in a big bear hug to mix the metaphors and pose for a photo.
The power of charisma. So not a trained zookeeper, but I mean, obviously he takes this very seriously. He's got all these animals from all over the world. He's feeding them, what, like 3,000 pounds of meat a week, you said. So once Crimea is annexed by Russia, how does Oleg's life change?
Dramatically, as it changed for lots of people in Crimea. He used to have all of his supply chains coming through mainland Ukraine. After annexation, he had to come up with new supply chains. And so now the prices for everything that Zubkov needs for the park have gone up. So it's become a real difficulty for him, not to mention after annexation, he and his parks became a target for local law enforcement agencies. And he's found himself spending well over 100 days a year wrapped up in these Kafkaesque court proceedings.
I'm speaking with Joshua Yaffa, the New Yorker's Moscow correspondent and the author of Between Two Fires. Josh, you also write about Elizaveta Glinka, Dr. Liza, as she's known. Something of a saint, it seems, and that's not really hyperbole. What is her story?
Dr. Liza came to prominence in Russia in the mid-2000s when she became really a pioneer of palliative care. She lived with some time with her husband in Vermont, where she encountered a hospice for the first time. And upon her return to Russia, she began doing something of the same with terminally ill patients in Moscow. And no one was really doing that before.
And going into the Donbass and eastern Ukraine and helping all people who were injured, correct?
Right. Well, that's the great turning point in her life after 2014, the outbreak of war in eastern Ukraine, in which there were very real victims. And Dr. Liza couldn't not help those in need. And when she learned that there were dozens, if not hundreds, of children trapped in the war zone, she appealed to the Kremlin, essentially. She appealed to those in power to give her the resources she needed to be able to get those people out of eastern Ukraine, to get them necessary medical care back in Russia. And that set in motion a relationship that would really change the way she was viewed by many in Russia.
Let's hear just a moment that kind of really underscores that tension between Dr. Liza and the Kremlin. This is a ceremony, and she's essentially being acknowledged for her humanitarian work.
Мы на стороне мира, диалога и сотрудничества со всеми людьми, потому что война – это ад на земле.
She said, "War is hell on earth," and she was narrating her own experience in the war zone, and it was her relationship with the Kremlin which both gave her more and more opportunities to help more and more people, but it was that closeness to the state that also drew a lot of criticism, that she allowed Putin to act the humanitarian in a conflict that he, in fact, bore primary responsibility for creating. The tragic coda in Dr. Liza's life is what that proximity to power eventually meant for her. After Russia entered the war in Syria in 2015, she performed a similar kind of function as she had in Ukraine, though this time with less enthusiasm, it sounds like. When the defense ministry asked her to go to Syria, she felt compelled to do that as well. And on one of those trips, she was flying to Syria. That plane crashed shortly after takeoff, killing everyone on board, including Dr. Lisa, quite tragically. Her proximity to power was the very thing that killed her. She wouldn't have been on that plane flying to Syria if she wasn't participating in the state mission.
Josh, with both Dr. Lisa and the story of the zookeeper, Oleg Zubkov, is the lesson kind of, if you're out there in Russia doing public work, can you manage to steer an apolitical path?
I think there is something that becomes unavoidable about negotiating and navigating compromise with the state. If you have ambitions that allow you to rise to a certain level, you do confront this inevitable dilemma of compromise because the state is so ever-present.
I just want to ask you about Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky. You met him back in August, profiled him for The New Yorker. What did he tell you?
I met Zelensky at what now, in hindsight, turns out to be a very interesting moment.
Right.
Because the story about what Trump and associates around him were doing in Ukraine hadn't really broken yet. But a lot had just transpired at the moment I saw Zelensky. And he vaguely alluded to some difficulties with the U.S. Large powers think of geopolitics as a chess game, but Zelensky is not going to allow Ukraine to be used as a pawn. It's clear that he was uneasy about navigating what was expected of him from the U.S. while also preserving Ukrainian interests. Of course, its position is much weaker if the U.S. is absent and much stronger if the U.S. is there getting Ukraine's back.
So Josh, as Between Two Fires clearly shows, you know the real stories from this part of the world. So what are Americans not hearing?
There's an American understanding of Russia as a place where a dictator, Putin, and his cronies keep a population locked in a cage with repression and propaganda against their will. But it's a very incomplete part of the story. Most people are really trying to get by, to live their lives. Most people really are in between. And I think that's a more telling and illustrative way of understanding Russia, but I think that's also the story of so many of our societies.
Joshua Yaffa is The New Yorker's Moscow correspondent. His new book is Between Two Fires, Truth, Ambition, and Compromise in Putin's Russia. Thanks for coming in to tell us these stories.
Thank you.
The Iowa caucuses are today. Some young Democrats are looking for a candidate who can do two things, beat Trump and protect the environment.
My candidate, I would say, is not the most progressive with climate, which is something that I'm not a fan of, but I still think he has a good plan, so yeah.
Young Iowans head out to caucus, coming up on The World. President Donald Trump has added new countries to his travel ban. Nigeria, Eritrea, Tanzania, Sudan, Kyrgyzstan, and Myanmar will now face new travel restrictions. The administration argues that its travel ban is vital to national security, but activists are calling the new list an Africa ban because four out of the six countries added are in Africa. The World's Halima Gakandi joins me in the studio now. So are all of these countries now part of Trump's travel ban?
Well, the new announcement prevents citizens from Nigeria, Eritrea, Burma, and Kyrgyzstan from obtaining immigrant visas, so they won't be able to immigrate to the country on immigrant visas. But when it comes to Tanzania and Sudan, they will now be excluded from participating in the diversity visa program, which is also the green card lottery. And it's historically been a way for people from countries that have low immigration rates to the country to get a chance to immigrate to the U.S.
So what is President Trump's explanation for this?
According to the Trump administration and the Department of Homeland Security, the issue comes down to security. The Department of Homeland Security has been doing a review over the past couple of months, issuing new requirements and standards, especially when it comes to identity management. And so they looked at countries that weren't meeting their security standards when it comes to that. And it also seems to be part of the Trump administration's effort to prevent and discourage what they view as illegal immigration.
Nigeria might be one of the most surprising additions exceptions to this list. Why is Nigeria on it?
It was really a surprise for people in Nigeria as well as Nigerian Americans because, of course, Nigeria and U.S. are major trade partners. They're major security partners. I spoke with Goodwin Nama, who moved to the U.S. as an immigrant on an immigrant visa 10 years ago. He's the president of the Nigerian American Multi-Service Association in Boston.
A person here who marries back home and wants to bring his wife and children here, it's going to be far more difficult under this restriction now. So it is an action that impacts more on Nigerian Americans than even Nigerian people living back home.
Yeah, so he's concerned. Halima, you mentioned security concerns as being the reason for these new travel restrictions. What are the legitimate security concerns with Nigeria?
Well, there are security concerns within Nigeria. Nigeria is facing a big issue with terrorism when it comes to Boko Haram and ISIS. That said, those security concerns are mostly within Nigeria and less so the United States. To that point, Texas U.S. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee on Friday, she said that security threats and terrorism are true for other countries too. So why aren't they on this list?
There's no doubt that there are terrorist elements roaming throughout various countries. But there are bad actions in Russia. There are bad actors in China. None of those places have been put on any ban. It is pure discrimination and racism.
And by the way, Representative Jackson Lee oversees a huge Nigerian immigrant community in Houston.
Are we seeing how this is affecting U.S.-Nigeria relations yet?
Well, that's a good question. Again, Nigeria and the U.S. are very close partners. And over the weekend, the office of Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari released a statement saying that the government will work on meeting these requirements of the Trump administration. He said that he's going to create a new committee to study and address some of their security concerns. But at the same time, it's pretty disappointing. Goodwin Nama, the Nigerian American in Boston, he says that these new visa restrictions remind him of some of the alleged comments from Trump about African nations.
It's another dimension to the comments about countries and all of that. And they really feel, is this government thinking that some Americans are less Americans than others?
Right. He's referring, of course, there to Trump's derisive comments from a few years back.
Yes. And what's ironic, Marco, is that there's a lot of support for Trump in Nigeria, especially when it comes to this issues of borders and security, as Nigerians have had to deal with this horrendous issue of terrorism, and they understand security and borders and why that's important. But when it comes to this particular limitations on regular Nigerians who are just trying to immigrate to the country, it's kind of making them rethink how they view Trump.
The world's Halima Gakandi, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Another country now on the Trump administration's list of travel restrictions is Kyrgyzstan.
To be honest, I think it's pretty unfair because I still don't understand why our country has been included to this list.
That's Bektur Iskender. He's a journalist based in Bishkek, the capital of Kyrgyzstan. Security concerns, as you heard, was one of the reasons that the Trump administration added Kyrgyzstan and five others to that list.
I just don't understand how does it apply to my country on one hand, because I wouldn't say that Kyrgyzstan is a dangerous country in any way. You know, I mean, it's not, I would say.
Bektur has traveled to the U.S. and other countries extensively, gave a TED talk telling people about his work and advocating for a free press.
When I would travel to the U.S., I would usually have to explain to people in general about the existence of my country. You know, people usually wouldn't know that it even exists.
So he would explain that Kyrgyzstan is in Central Asia. It used to be a part of the Soviet Union, but now it's a small independent country with about 6 million people.
But then the only prejudice that I have really faced a lot while being in the U.S. is that, you know, my country has the ending Stan, and that freaks out many Americans.
You know, countries like Afghanistan, Pakistan. Even if Kyrgyzstan does end in Stan, Bektur doesn't feel that his country or the other countries recently added to the travel ban list should be singled out with new travel restrictions.
And I think generalizing people just on the basis of where they were born is fundamentally wrong. What makes me different from anyone else in the world? What makes me different from people from privileged countries?
The Trump administration's expanded travel restrictions are scheduled to take effect on February 21st. Northwest Syria is seeing one of the world's most severe humanitarian crises. That's according to the World Health Organization. Intense fighting in that part of the country has been going on for several months. The Syrian government and its allies have been battling opposition groups there. As a result, more than 500,000 people do not have access to medical services. For the woman at the center of our next story, the news from Northwest Syria brings back some dark memories. She also lived through a long-term siege in an area outside of Damascus, but as a doctor, she felt it was her duty to stay and help. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari.
Let's go back to the spring of 2013. Syrian government forces had laid siege to a neighborhood outside of the capital.
That video shows the dramatic scenes in Syria's eastern Ghouta, which is east of Damascus. Observers say over 100 civilians have been killed there in the past 24 hours.
Some 400,000 people were cut off from the outside world. Syrian forces carried out airstrikes on a daily basis, according to the United Nations. They also burned crops to starve the population there. Food became so scarce in eastern Ghouta that the UN says some families lived on tree leaves and grass. Amani Balur was in the middle of it all. She had just graduated from Damascus University and was about to start medical school to become a pediatrician.
I had to choose if I want to stay in the eastern Ghouta or I had to stay in Damascus city to complete studying.
She decided to stay in Ghouta, the very place that came to witness the longest running siege in modern history, 5 years. Balur had very little medical experience outside of the classroom. Still, she volunteered to treat the wounded at a hospital that was under construction.
It was about 2 or 3 rooms at the beginning, so we make emergency room and other room for operation.
Balur watched as eastern Ghouta slowly transformed into a ghost town.
At that time, you couldn't see anyone on the surface. All the people in some shelters underground, and some people stayed for 3 or 4 days without food, and they couldn't get out.
In 2018, MSF, the medical NGO, reported that some 70% of the people in one neighborhood lived in basements and shelters underground. Balur and her small team became an essential part of that subterranean life. She tells me when the airstrikes got intense, they decided to move the operating room to the basement of the hospital.
We fix it because it's supposed to be a kitchen, so we work a lot on this place to make it a good place to be hospital.
They nicknamed the dark, airless space the cave, or al-kahf in Arabic. This is sound from a documentary shot inside the cave. Often, Balur's patients were kids that were pulled out of the rubble following intense airstrikes. Sometimes she had no other option but to amputate their limbs.
Children didn't understand that, and they ask why and how this happened, why you cut my hand. And we stood without answers.
Balur was so busy, she barely found time to process what was happening around her. Except, she says, in the rare quiet moments in her office when she broke down in tears.
You know, it's difficult to stay in this place, but it was my choice. I wanted to stay with these people.
As the years went on, Balur and her team expanded the underground hospital. They dug tunnels that connected the hospital to the Syrian capital, Damascus.
It became a very big place, very strong.
In 2018, the Syrian government intensified its attack on eastern Ghouta. This time, Balur says, it was as if the forces had upgraded their weapons.
They started to bomb every second and all the time during the day and the night, bomb everything. Even they bombed the shelters underground.
Eventually, Balur and her team were forced to leave.
I can't describe what I felt, but you take my soul. It's really my soul.
Balur fled to northern Syria. She spent 3 months there, got married, and moved to Turkey. That's where she lives now. Last month, the Council on Europe, a human rights organization, awarded Balur a prize for her work in eastern Ghouta.
Actually, it's an honor to me, and I'm very thankful for...
The story of the underground hospital is captured in a National Geographic documentary called The Cave. The documentary has been nominated for an Oscar. I asked Balur if she knows what happened to the cave after they left.
Yes, I know. Assad regime closed the cave and it's empty now.
She hopes to one day return to Ghouta and continue her medical work. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
President Trump seems determined to roll back as many policies from the Obama era as he can. Now add to that list, relaxing restrictions on the Pentagon's use of landmines. Trump argues that the partial ban put U.S. soldiers at a severe disadvantage. And his Pentagon chief, Mark Esper, agrees. He calls landmines an important tool to ensure mission success and to reduce risk to forces. 164 nations, though, see things differently. They signed a treaty banning the use of landmines. Ken Rutherford has spent the past few decades advocating on behalf of that treaty. He learned about the dangers of anti-personnel landmines firsthand when he was an aid worker in Somalia in 1993. A heads up here, he details his injuries in this interview.
We're going out to visit a project site. My assistant manager, Mohammed Hassan Dwali, was to my right. My driver was to my left. There was a donkey cart in the road. The right front tire hit the mine. And then basically the right part of the vehicle disappeared. But unfortunately, that's where my legs were. I just went blind. I couldn't see. And then when the dust and everything cleared, you know, I was looking out at a blown out windshield. And then I just noticed, you know, there's a foot on the floorboard, and I didn't know if it was mine or Muhammad's.
Wow.
And then a bystander lost an arm. And the only reason I know all that is because I crawled out of the vehicle. I grabbed the steering wheel, pulled myself out, put my legs up on the driver's seat and tied tourniquets around both of my legs.
You remember the setting pretty well, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, I live it every day. Every day you're not below 6 feet in the ground is a great day.
So, Ken, you nearly bled to death. As you say, one leg amputated initially to save your life. The second had to be amputated some time later. When you go back in time and think about that day, you think about that landmine, do you also think about the person who planted it and what they were thinking?
I still haven't. Maybe now that you asked the question, because everybody was using them back then. As an American, I didn't really know anything about landmines. Humanitarian demining became a global issue around that time because of Cambodia in 1992, with the refugees returning after the Cambodian peace accords. And in Afghanistan in late 1980s, a couple British demining groups, Halo Trust, Mines Advisory Group. That's when the world really recognized that landmines was a global problem because so many people were being injured. And the International Campaign to Ban Landmines won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997. That's when it was started.
Obviously, a lot of that has changed for you. You went on to co-found the Landmine Survivors Network. You also escorted Princess Diana on her last humanitarian mission to visit landmine survivors in Bosnia-Herzegovina. That was just weeks before she died. What did that movement accomplish, do you think?
This movement was mid-sized states, Norway, South Africa, Belgium, Canada, for example, and NGOs, non-governmental organizations, getting together to fundamentally alter the way you could talk about weapons, which historically was a monopoly controlled by the major powers, India, China, the United States, Russia, and the world community got together to ban a weapon that was destroying lives and taking people's limbs.
So, Ken, what are you thinking now, hearing this news that the Trump White House has reversed the restrictions on landmines?
And I don't know what President Trump is thinking on this. There's just other ways that we could accomplish military objectives without using landmines. And I'm just saying that as an American. I have a son in the U.S. Marines. I'm disappointed but not surprised.
The Pentagon now argues that in a more dangerous world, the military needs all the tools possible to defend and to fight. Do you not think your son, a Marine, would benefit from one more tool in his toolbox?
There's some weapons that are beyond the pale of civilization. We don't have landmines infested in American soil. But in Cambodia or Afghanistan or Colombia, you do. And long after wars end, these mines continually be eternally vigilant and take off limbs.
Well, I was just seeing some kind of stunning statistics that landmines killed more than 3,000 people in 2018, and more than half of those numbers were children. Over the years, I'm guessing you've met a lot of survivors who must have also been kids. How do they cope?
That is one of the missions of my life, making sure they're not forgotten. And it's the people in the rural areas, the poor, the marginalized, and they don't make the front page of our newspapers because they're indiscriminate. Once you lay it in the soil and walk away, you can't tell who's going to be there.
Ken Rutherford, a professor of political science at James Madison University. He also co-founded the Landmine Survivors Network. Ken, really appreciate your time today. Thank you for speaking with us about landmines.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
It feels like the Democratic presidential campaign has been with us for quite a while now, but today things get real with the Iowa caucuses. This is where the large field of candidates starts getting whittled down. Our reporter, Rupa Shenoy, happens to be from Iowa. She went back to her home state to speak with people preparing for tonight.
Hi.
Hi.
I went back to my old public high school in Cedar Rapids to talk to three members of the Sunrise Movement. It's a group of young, diverse people fighting for action on climate change.
My name's Isha.
Isha's parents are from India. Her mom's an IT manager, and her dad owns a grocery store, which already blows me away, because my family drove to Chicago every month for Indian groceries.
I'm Elise, by the way.
Elise Cagnard's family moved to the U.S. when she was three for her father's job. He's from France, and her mom's from Morocco. Elise is a dual citizen.
And I'm Kit.
Kit Iyer is a dual citizen, too. Her parents are from India, and her dad helps out at the local Hindu temple. There was no temple when I lived here. And the school definitely wasn't this big.
All of this is new.
Yeah, this whole is an addition.
Only a dozen or so kids belong to the Sunrise chapter here. But these three say it's made them feel connected to young people everywhere. This is Kit.
When I was reading about like the strikes that were going on everywhere across the globe, I think that was very empowering.
When the Swedish environmental activist Greta Thunberg came to Iowa City, Kit and Isha went to see her speak. Isha says she couldn't see the end of the crowd.
And it truly shows you that, like, you're not alone.
For Elise, her interest in climate activism led naturally to the Iowa caucus.
When I realized we could pick, like, presidential candidates based on their climate plans, that's what I realized. It's a lot about the politics.
That's also when she realized something about the candidate she'd already picked out, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
My candidate, I would say, is not the most progressive with climate, which is something that I'm not a fan of, but I still think he has a good plan.
Elise says Buttigieg is still the best candidate across all the issues. She's going to caucus for him because 17-year-olds can take part in Iowa, along with her parents, who became citizens in August. Elise actually went to a Buttigieg campaign caucus training.
And they give you a lot of, like, background information, and if this happens, do this. If that happens, do that. So I feel like I'm a little bit more prepared for it.
Kit's parents are Democrats who have caucused in the past, and she's joining them this year. She thinks she's had an influence on them.
I don't know how many people I've impacted through, like, my climate stuff and this stuff and, like, when I'm just at school talking with people. But I do know for sure that, like, I feel like my parents are a little bit more aware and educated because of me.
All three students say changing minds here at school is difficult. They're well aware that most of their fellow students lean Republican. That surprised me because politics was something we never talked about at school. But it doesn't seem to have created a partisan conflict, even now. Kit says liberal students feel comfortable speaking out.
I sometimes forget that we, like, don't actually go to a very diverse school. When I would see, like, the Trump rallies, I would just see, like, so many people just shouting. And, like, it doesn't really translate here. I feel like there's so many Iowans that I know that are just so respectful and nice.
That's an Iowan thing that existed when I lived here, too. It still feels like a live and let live kind of place, but not for everyone. This is something I hear from Tony Smith. He's an African-American pastor in Iowa City.
We've had churches that have had hate propaganda. We've had flyers from national hate groups that have distributed literature in our neighborhoods.
He shows me a picture of one of the flyers that they think was put up on Christmas Day. It says, "Send them back. They can't make white babies." One recent hate incident here made national news. A woman near Des Moines told police that she drove into a teenager because the girl looked Mexican. Smith's caucusing tonight, but he says he's disappointed that no candidates of color remain in the race.
I'm hurt because I believe that because of Kamala and Corey and Julian Castro, all of them being out, now we lose that voice. Now we have to put all of our emphasis on those that may not see things for our best interests.
But Smith acknowledges that locally, people of color can't get things done alone. There aren't enough of them. So Smith's congregation is teaming up with other religious groups and Latino organizations to form a coalition to speak up for things that matter to them. Meg Wagner's also part of the effort. She's a white Episcopal priest working on racial justice issues and drives around the state visiting churches large and small.
And serving congregations who might only have 20 people in them, but have people who voted for Donald Trump, actually one who would probably dress in all Trump attire if she could on a Sunday morning, and women who marched in Des Moines in pussy hats.
Wagner says it's getting harder to have conversations about things that matter.
Preaching in the age of Trump is a challenging thing.
She says that's why it's become important to look for support and strength where they can, like the Interfaith Coalition.
And we don't agree on everything. We're not all going to be at the Pride Parade together. But finding those alliances, I think, is going to be increasingly important to be able to get stuff done.
The Sunrise Movement's members at my old high school hope climate change is one of those issues that people can agree on. Here's Isha Kalia again.
I'll talk to people, even conservatives, and they're like, yes, I definitely think climate's an issue, and I definitely think things should be done about it. They'll have different views on what should be done about it and how we should approach the issue, but I've talked to very few people who just don't believe in it altogether.
Isha's also caucusing tonight, and she's willing to compromise on climate change, too, because her highest priority is choosing a candidate who can beat President Trump. And she thinks even Republicans would vote for Pete Buttigieg.
I personally have talked to people at my high school who are Republicans and still support Pete because I just think he's a little bit more moderate.
Isha says she's dragging along her politically moderate parents to the caucus. She's not telling them who to support because at school she's learned it's okay to disagree. The goal, all three students tell me, is to get more people involved. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
The impeachment trial of President Trump officially adjourned today, but senators are still getting 10 minutes each to speak their minds on the Senate floor. Today, Democratic House managers, then White House lawyers, made their closing arguments. Democrat Hakeem Jeffries said the consequences of acquitting the president would be dire.
To condone the president's obstruction would strike a death blow to the impeachment clause in the Constitution. And if Congress cannot enforce this sole power vested in both chambers alone, the Constitution's final line of defense against a corrupt presidency will be eviscerated.
The president's defense team again stressed this point. This trial was all about politics, an attempt to discredit the president during an election year. Here's Trump's lawyer, Jay Sekulow.
This entire campaign of impeachment that started from the very first day that the president was inaugurated was a partisan one, and it should never happen again. For 3 years, this push for impeachment came straight from the president's opponents, and when it finally reached a crescendo, it put this body, the United States Senate, into a horrible position.
Tomorrow, senators will finish their floor speeches, and Wednesday, the final vote on whether to remove President Trump from office or acquit him of the charges. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.